Namaste and welcome to the Bharatvarta Weekly. Thank you for joining us on this premiere. I have Nirav Kanodra and Abhishek Paul with me here today to take you through the news and events of the week that was. We have plenty to talk about. Of course, we'll be bringing you updates on the situation in Afghanistan. It seems to be deteriorating. We also have updates on COVID, both the vaccination and also the new cases that seem to be spiky in certain parts of the country. We'll take you through politics in Maharashtra. There seems to be some bit of controversy there as well. We spoke about China last week, the implosion of tech stocks and so on. We're going to give you an update on that as well. Talk about something called adjusting excessive income. Nirav can talk about that in a little more detail. Of course, we will also talk about the new vehicle registration that was launched and the Tokyo Paralympics as well. So we have plenty of ground to cover. So can't wait to get started. All right. As usual, let's talk about the episode that we put out last week. So this was a premium only episode, and Vivek Khaitan, who you would have heard on many different podcasts earlier, brought to us fascinating insights, anecdotes, facts, and perspectives on Mathura, which is one of the holiest sites for the Hindus. So he recounted the history and significance of the place and also the various battles that have taken place there and what is the status at the moment, right? So fascinating episode. Do check it out and also join Bharatvarta on YouTube for premium access to content like this. With that out of the way, let's get started with our first piece of news for this week. Union Minister Narayan Rane has been arrested after his statement against Maharashtra Chief Minister Uddhav Thackeray. He stated that he would have given the CM a tight slap for missing count of the years of India's independence. The arrest was made after an order issued by the Nasik SP following an FIR filed against Mr. Rane. 3 days after the arrest, he made a statement against the CM again, this time stating, "All the secrets have been buried in my heart for 39 years. I will open one after the other." Nirav, this seems to be like a soap opera playing out in public. What do you see happening here?
Maharashtra has four political parties, and it's going to be a complex dance leading into the BMC election in Feb 2022. So Narayan Rane is actually an ex-Shiv Sena chief minister. After that, he's gone to the Congress and now he's moved to BJP. The thing over here is that no one really spoke a lot about Uddhav Thackeray's Independence Day speech and his blooper over there. And Narayan Rane made the comment about him giving a tight slap in a small rally in Raigad. This would not have blown out of proportion had it not been for the FIR launched against him. And so he's been booked under the IPC section 500 for defamation, 505 for promoting mischief, 153 for remarks likely to cause disharmony, enmity or hatred. Rane has already been released posting a bail of like 15,000 rupees, right? What has happened is, I would compare it to like the Streisand effect on the internet. When you try to suppress something, it actually becomes more popular inadvertently. And here, Narayan Rane, who has been politician and strongman in the Konkan region of Maharashtra, is not only made popular all across Maharashtra, but all across the country. And the CM's blooper, which would have gone unnoticed, has actually come to the forefront. I think we'll see more of such barbs going each way. And I think it's just, let's take the popcorn and watch the show as it unfolds.
Right. Fantastic. Entertaining for sure. Let's move to some geopolitics now. Earlier this week, two suicide bombers and gunmen attacked the Kabul airport. The attack killed at least 60 Afghans and 13 US troops. IS offshoot Islamic State Khorasan province were found to be responsible for the attack. The US government responded by launching a drone strike against a planner of the Islamic State attack. The strike took place in Nangarhar province, east of Kabul and bordering Pakistan, and was reported to be successful. Abhishek, for more than a couple of weeks now, we've been bringing updates on the Afghanistan situation. It seems to be deteriorating, right?
Yes, so this was a tragic attack near the Kabul airport, which has led to the death of many people, right? 13 US Marines, and the death toll count is uncertain, but some estimates say as high as 180. So now what has happened is there's a lot of focus on A, who did the attack, B, which is ISIS-K, and B, what is their relationship with Taliban, and C, what will be like the reaction of the United States to it. Just to go one by one on each of them briefly, ISIS-K is like a terrorist group operating in Afghanistan, parts of Western Pakistan and other parts of Central Asia, which got formed in 2015. Not very clear as to what are their exact links with the original ISIS group, but they tend to have the similar sort of ideology being talked about as even basically going for a much more hardline stance than even groups like Taliban. They have been conducting numerous terror attacks over the last 5-6 years, including one very lethal attack this year itself near a girls' school in Afghanistan. So now the question is, how does this impact the current Taliban regime change that is ongoing? And the consensus seems to be that Taliban are probably not linked directly to this attack because they would not have wanted this to happen while this transition of government was happening. And it is also reported that ISIS-K fighters who are primarily coming from Pakistan have been, you know, fighting locally with the Taliban fighters for a certain period of time. So these two groups are probably rival groups. And finally, in terms of the response, as you said, the US has launched a drone attack in retaliation, taking out one or two mid-level planners of ISIS-K. But we have to wait and see what more retaliation happens. As the deadline for the US complete withdrawal comes close, I think it's expected that by the end of the month, all US will be leaving. And we have to see how many actually people are left behind, those that needed to be evacuated. And then we need to see what more leverage and how much command and control the US retains in order to carry out any retaliatory attack. Because there are reports coming out that there are some more attacks expected in the next few days as this final stage of evacuation and withdrawal continues.
Yeah, today I think President Biden has come out with a statement that another attack is unlikely, right? Which means the probability for the inverse has just shot up, right? I mean, in all of our estimates. Keeping with international news, amidst China's tech crackdown, Xi Jinping has emphasized the need for adjusting to, quote, excessive income. Chinese tech stocks have been undergoing a roller coaster ride of rallies and drops due to market shocks. The Chinese state-owned media is attempting image control by coining new phrases to explain the clampdowns. Nirav, we spoke about this last week as well. We're seeing social engineering at a remarkable scale, right? So what is really happening here?
What the Chinese president in last week's meeting of the Central Finance and Economics Committee, he has emphasized adjusting excessive income, and he's used the phrase promotion of common prosperity. Now, this phrase was first used by Chairman Mao, and then it has also been used by Xi Jinping in 2017. And so he's re-emphasizing this as China in its policies is moving from focus on growth to focus on redistribution. So if you see that they had been aligning with the world and with global trade since 1978, when Deng Xiaoping tried to open up, they had the liberalization movement then. And at that time, to his critics, he said that doesn't matter if the cat is black or white, as long as it catches mice. So when his critics are saying that, oh, this is leaving the principles of communism, he says, don't worry, some people get rich first and let us move ahead. And then in 2001, when China joined WTO, at that time the phrase was capitalism with Chinese characteristics, saying that yes, they will be capitalist, but in a Chinese way. They are not going to ape the West completely. Now they've had 40 years of very rapid growth and it has been very unbalanced. So you see some tech companies with a lot of control over data, very powerful. A lot of them have been backed by foreign investors like SoftBank and investors in the West. And this is a problem. So what has happened is they are trying to say that there will be common prosperity. So they want to redistribute this wealth across the country. And a lot of companies have taken the hint. So companies such as Xiaomi, the smartphone maker, online retailer Pinduoduo, food delivery platform Meituan, Tencent Holdings, all of them have come out with a common prosperity budget where they will be spending money to fund areas in research, agriculture, clean energy, and social development programs. So I would look at it as a form of say, additional taxation at this particular sector. China also kind of, as like last week, even Abhishek had mentioned, they are focusing on the tech which they like, which is probably like areas like AI and 5G, companies like Huawei, and the tech which they don't like, which is online gaming or ed tech and those kind of companies. So you are seeing some readjustment, as I believe like this is a turn which they've just taken like a left turn, but it is a big super tanker drifting. As a foreign investor, I would think that this makes Chinese tech sector a little less attractive because of the additional costs imposed on them.
Absolutely. And it's going to have effects on, you know, the money coming into India as well, right? I mean, obviously, it's going to be a positive thing for us. All right, closer home, the government has introduced a new vehicle registration series for seamless transfer across states. A vehicle with Bharat or BH mark will not require a new registration mark when the owner shifts from one state to another. This facility will be available on voluntary basis to defense personnel, employees of state and central government, and state and central PSUs. Abhishek, this seems like something that was long due, right? I mean, very commonsensical in some sense.
As of now, whenever people move across state, they get a 12-month window to change their vehicle registration. And it's a sort of pretty inconvenient for folks who have jobs which require them to move frequently, right, between cities. So this is an excellent step taken by the government to have a sort of national registration series, which can be utilized by, as you said, defense folks or central government employees or even people who work in the private sector but have jobs and who work in organizations spanning multiple states and cities. So now the interesting thing to see is, A, what will be the reaction of the various state governments, if at all any, because you could say that you're sort of taking away a bit of their taxation powers. On the other hand, I think it will be a fairly positive, it will be received well by the public. Essentially, to the public, it's like a convenience being added to them. And so my guess is that the pushback, if at all, will be fairly muted and limited, but we'll have to wait and see. Let's hope that this gets implemented pretty soon.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely removes friction for sure. The coalition of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, or BRICS as it's known, is opposing the EU's carbon border tax. The coalition has opposed this proposal, which seeks to levy a border tax on import of carbon-intensive goods. The tax will be enforced from 2026 onwards. The anti-climate dumping tool would slap additional levies on imported goods that are manufactured in an unsustainable way. This is aimed at boosting domestic production and giving offshore industries an incentive to go green. Nirav, what is the consequence of this tax and what are the countries opposed to?
EU within itself has some form of a carbon tax. But the complaint over there is that if they are importing goods from another country, those firms do not have a carbon tax. And hence, it is a disadvantage to EU companies. Border levy is going to be phased in from 2026. And it is a protectionist measure to protect European companies. In from 2023 to 25, there's going to be a transition phase which will see importers monitoring and reporting their emissions. Now, India has been one of the first one to oppose it. And now the BRICS country in the BRICS summit, they've all joined India, saying that this is quite regressive because poorer countries are lagging behind in transition to cleaner energy. EU has been on the forefront and hence this is very regressive. So while India is working towards zero emissions, India does want to phase out a lot of the polluting industries and usage of coal. But at the current moment, a lot of India's power is generated by coal and paying such a tax would cripple India's exports. So I think this is definitely like an unfair policy. If you look, the European countries are still emitting per capita a lot more emissions than the poorer countries. So to expect poorer countries to pay up a higher tax kind of is regressive. And that's why, so once you have a forum and here the BRICS forum is a nice place to voice your concerns against unequal policies, probably we will see some sort of this policy being watered down or pushed back further. So I think it's a very good step. This is India taking leadership over here, which is a great thing.
Yeah, I'd urge all the listeners to check out the episode we did with Sri Jayansinha as well, where, you know, we spoke about net zero emissions. And, Sinaji specifically spoke about how you can grow as well in a very sustainable way, right? I mean, oftentimes we're asked to choose between one or the other. So yeah, a lot of related insights on that episode. Do check it out. In other news, while COVID vaccinations have been going on at a tremendous pace, there are also some worrying spikes in parts of India. India on Friday administered over 1 crore vaccine doses under the nationwide vaccination drive. This is the highest ever vaccination achieved in a single day since the start of the vaccination. On the other side of the coin, Kerala reported 13,500 cases per day in July and almost 19,500 daily cases in August. The state accounted for 70% of the new cases on Saturday. Abhishek, what do you see happening? I mean, it's at one end, you see like extreme positivity, and at the other end, I mean, there seems to be no respite at all.
So on the vaccine front, pretty good news coming out in terms of vaccine delivery. Our pace has picked up significantly. So while in May, we were doing about 19 lakh vaccines per day, in June and July, we were about 40 to 43 lakh. For this month, our average is closer to 60 lakhs, right? Around 57, 58 lakhs right now, which is very impressive. And as our vaccine sort of pace has increased, the gap taken for the number of days for every 10 crore is like falling, right? So we did our first 10 crore vaccines in like 85 days, while it took just 19 days for us to move from, say, 50 to 60 crores. Right now, I think we are close to 63 crores. So I think the basic goal of the government is to vaccinate all adults by the end of the year. We look to be closing in on that target. I think there will come up a point soon where the population unvaccinated will be those who are basically hesitant to take. But basically, we have to move to a point where at least we have no shortage of supply, and it's finally the last mile, right? Those last 2 out of 10 people who will be sort of hesitating to take the vaccine. But till then, it makes sense for India to push on really hard. On the state level, as you said, cases, Kerala is a distinct outlier right now. And so the Kerala story has been pretty interesting in how it has played out in terms of the numbers as well as the perception in the media. So last year, at the start of the pandemic, Kerala managed to do really well to keep the case count very low, much lower than the average. And it was sort of very well spoken of in the media in terms of their health minister getting a lot of kudos and a lot of talk of the Kerala model. It finally took Onam 2020 for basically the first spike to happen in Kerala, which was considerable period of time after when the cases had spiked in the rest of the country. Now, this year, what has happened is while the big second wave of April, May coincided for both Kerala and the rest of the country. Since then, June, July, August, while cases in the rest of the country have plunged, Kerala cases are not going down to that extent, and in fact are pretty close to their peak. So like they had a peak in May of around 42,000-43,000 cases, and they are now back to around 30,000 plus in the last few days. So that is quite a substantial number. Now, of course, portion of the media is spinning this also as a virtue, saying that they're able to capture cases much better than the rest of the country while the others are doing an undercounting. Now, you can't be right on both counts, that you had low cases and that was great last year, and you have high cases and that is great this year. So they have to decide which year their performance is actually good. That aside, what is true and that cannot be denied is that, let's say, if you look at a metric like deaths per day, that is significantly higher this year for Kerala than last year, right? Or even earlier parts of this year. So that is something that they cannot deny. It is correct that Kerala has a pretty decent healthcare system. So they have been able to sort of deal with the surge much better than what many other states would have had if the similar sort of volume of cases would have continued. They need to get their act together pretty soon, because ultimately this trade-off of having large number of cases versus opening up will come up, right? If the cases start rise even more, they'll have to think of more stringent lockdowns, and that is not something anyone wants, because ultimately we need to open up, the economy needs to get going.
Apparently there's something called a triple lockdown that has been imposed in certain sections of Kerala, right? Okay, moving on. It's not a particularly good time if you are a cricket fan, but then the Tokyo 2021 Paralympics are underway and some Indian athletes are already in the spotlight. Table tennis player Bhavina Patel continued her winning spree at the Tokyo Paralympics, and also Indian archer Rakesh Kumar has done really, really well as well. So Nirav, who do we have to watch out for?
Yeah, so actually earlier today, Bhavina Patel got the silver medal. She lost in the finals, unfortunately, to Chinese player Inju. Bhavina Patel was the only non-Chinese in the semis. Last Rio 2016 Olympics, we had won in like women's shot put, men's javelin, and those events are still pending. Today itself, later today, we have archery eliminations. We have the men's high jump finals where we have Nishad Kumar. We have the men's discus throw in the finals where we have Vinod Kumar. So it's a good continuation from like the Tokyo Olympics, where in Paralympics, we see that even differently abled athletes are making their mark. And it's also very encouraging for everyone to take up sport regardless of their abilities. I think India has been a sports watching nation, and hopefully we've transitioned to become a sports playing nation.
And finally, to round things off, Finance Minister Nirmala Sitharamanji has launched a national monetization pipeline. The plan aims to monetize rupees 6 trillion of brownfield infrastructure assets over a period of 4 years. Among the projects, the government has also identified 26,700 kilometers of roads, 400 railway stations, 90 passenger trains, 28,600 kilometers of transmission lines, BharatNet fiber network, and BSNL MTNL towers as well. Abhishek, you know, Twitter should rejoice, right? I mean, this is something that people have been talking about for years and years. What do you think?
Yeah, so this is a sort of semi-privatization kind of an initiative. It's not something which is totally new or unique. I mean, we've had this model before, but probably in ad hoc ways. Basically, the concept is very simple. The government, as you said, has identified a pipeline of assets owned by the government, which could be roads, it could be airports, etc. And then they will basically give it over to a private party for upfront cash. That private party will then operate it and make money for a particular period of time, let's say 15 years or 25 years, and then return back the asset to the government. The government, using this upfront payment, will then invest that in other infrastructure projects. So that's a very sort of basic concept behind this. The value, as you said, in dollars is about 80, 81 billion over the next 3.5 years up to 2025. Now, there are a few things to watch out for and not necessary. So one is in terms of implementation. So how does the implementation happen? Whether we are able to actually do it in the time frame required, right? And we'll have to see how much of the 81 billion actually comes through. The other aspects are sort of pretty political. So while the opposition charge of selling off the country's asset can be kept aside, but there are other political aspects to watch out for. So the government frequently faces charges of quote-unquote crony capitalism. So if it is the same few houses, then that is another charge which the opposition will sort of drum up. The other interesting aspect is basically how do India's public and consumers perceive this action. So now the whole talk is that, you know, this is about efficient utilization of assets. That means the private party will be able to monetize this better. Now, that can happen via two ways, right? So they're able to utilize it or do things more efficiently. But that can and give better services, let's say, to the consumer, better experience to the consumer. But that can also result in, let's say, a price rise for the consumer. So that political angle is something to be watched out for. So, for example, let's talk about a road. Right. So you are a frequent user of a highway. Now, you may like it that the highway is better maintained. You're able to easily sort of access it in terms of paying the toll becomes easier and all that. So that's something that a consumer will be, it will be a plus for the consumer. But let's say the private party hikes the toll, right? And you don't think then that it's making sense or the value add is not enough. So then that's something which can be like a political cost for the government. So let's see how it works out. I mean, I think once that they have announced it, it obviously means that they have taken the political cost into the equation and still going ahead with it. But let's hope that this reform goes through a bit more smoother than some of the other recent ones like the labor or the farm reforms.
Yeah, but I think in this case, they've also smartly sort of outsourced some of this political stuff to the states itself, right? By creating incentives for them, right? Yeah, so it won't be the sort of wholesale disinvestment that, you know, one saw during the Vajpayee era, at least I feel, right? So, definitely a move in the positive direction, I would say, right? All right, so that's a wrap from us here at the Bharat Vartha Weekly. We have a couple of fascinating episodes coming up. We have one focused on EV in India. Of course, electric vehicles are huge. You know, you're seeing a lot of activity in that space, and we're going to talk about innovation and policy, right? We'll have a good balance of perspectives on this, and do check it out. And also recently, Shri Kalyan Singh Ji passed away, and on the back of that, we will also talk about the rise of OBC politics in India and what that means, the evolution and so on. Of course, it'll be brought to you by our resident political expert, Rohit Jayaraman. A couple of very interesting episodes coming up. Do watch out for this. And thank you so much for joining us, everyone. It's been a pleasure bringing you the news and views for this week. And until next time, stay safe, take care, and Jai Hind.